Right. Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. I'm very happy to be back with KZYX today with the second in a new series of programs. It follows our series talking about California, but is geographically a little broader in subject matter. On these past programs, you may remember discussions with Raj Patel, Rebecca Solnit, Alice Walker, Robin Kelly, Ignacio Chapella, Mike Davis, and others. This summer's series will be similar. I'm calling it an antinomian hour. Antinomian is an old word I should repeat. It describes an old concept. I'm using the word antinomian to describe people who work against the grain, people who believe in doing the right thing, that doing the right thing is the important thing, and people who feel no obligation to obey rules that they consider arbitrary or even just constraining, whatever the source. Our program will consist of a series of in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX every Thursday this summer at 1 p.m. Our guest today is Barbara Garson. Barbara lives in Manhattan. She's a writer and an activist. She's a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, where she majored in history. Barbara may still be known to some listeners as the author of MacBird, the hilarious 1966 parody of Macbeth in which the main characters were Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, a play that has since sold more than 500,000 copies. She's written many plays since then, but more recently, Barbara is the author of a series of projects, examinations of ordinary people and the work they do. The series began with All the Live Long Day, the meaning and demeaning of routine work. She later wrote The Electronic Sweatshop, how computers are transforming the office of the future into the factory of the past. And her latest book is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. It was published just last year by Doubleday. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Cal.
It's okay to call you Barbara.
Yes, and I'm so glad you have learned the word antinomian.
Okay.
I'm going to say that to anybody in the family who says to me, you're just stubborn. Grow up.
Right.
No, I'm an antinomian.
Yeah, well, it's it goes back to the 17th century at least. Well, to dissenters, it's the original dissenters. Barbara, can we begin a little bit about your general subject matter, ordinary work? Why have you chosen this?
Used to say, there's only two things in life. Work and love. And I figured, what have I got to say about love? So I'm writing about work. Okay. But I actually am, it's what most of us do most of our waking lives if we're lucky enough to have the job. And it's where people are either forced to be inhuman and fight to express their humanity or their sense of purpose or sense of getting something accomplished. So I've been writing about that for every decade, and unfortunately, I've also been tracking what we now call inequality. That is to say, I've been tracking what happens to working people every decade as bad conditions and bad wages move higher and higher up the career ladder.
And
I didn't think when I started that that's what I was writing about.
Well, was it different when you were writing about the All the Live Long Day, your book, your first book on this subject?
Sure. When I was writing that, now mind you, we were just on the verge of what was going to happen the last 40 years of increasing inequality. But people then were thinking, it started with a chapter on auto workers. In the fastest assembly line in the world, young people who went on strike against the speed of the line. And Harper's Magazine sent me down there to see about what they thought would be the wave of the future, young people who were talking about humanizing work instead of what we talk about now, getting a job no matter what. And it was really great to talk to these guys who I had met literally one person, but a type of people that I had met when I worked in an anti-war GI coffee house during the Vietnam War. And, I mean, here were these young people who could always quit a job if they wanted and get another crummy dead-end job, but it always covered the rent. I mean, what a different time than now.
And where was this?
Well, I went everywhere, as I always did, but I started at the Lordstown plant in Ohio. And it was at that time General Motors had done an experiment to set up the fastest assembly line in the world, and they hired young people because they thought they wouldn't get the recalcitrance they would get from old UAW members. And also these kids were strong and young, could work fast. But instead of that, they got sabotage and people slowing down the line and people wanting a different car, a better car, all kinds of things. It was amazing. It was wonderful.
And the word demeaning of work, what's how's that?
Well, I think we all want to feel we're accomplishing something at work, or even not at work. And so this deliberately dividing jobs into the smallest little parts you could have, then it was on an assembly line, now it's the person who presses the button in McDonald's and doesn't even do the adding up, doesn't even know what things cost, they just press a symbol of a hamburger. So it's taking the sense of satisfaction out of it. And I love talking to people who put that sense back, even if it meant, say, doing the job blindfolded and see if they could keep up the line. Sometimes it meant sabotaging, but just as often you see people slowing down and you think, oh, they're trying to, you know, this is in a lumber plant, they're trying to cause a crash on the line. No, then they'd race to speed up so that at the last minute they could feel, you know, a variety in their pace. And I just, you know, was so touched by how much people want to have some challenge and get things done. Oh, you could see the opposite, too. You could see people sabotaging also, of course.
And how had things changed by the time you wrote The Electronic Sweatshop?
Well, in all the livelong day, I wasn't just writing about what young people hope jobs would turn into. I also described that each place I went was a tuna fish factory, you know, cutting up tuna into the little chunks that go into the cans, whatever it was. I described what the management had done to make it a simple job where one place the person could replace each other with, you know, half an hour's training. Now it's less than half an hour, of course, at McDonald's. And when I started hearing in the 80s that soon industrial work was dead, but we would soon, not to worry, we would soon all be information workers in the post-industrial society, and that was going to be really glorious. But then I started meeting the people actually doing it, people whose necks hurt and eyes hurt from entering data, all the way up the line to brokers who said, oh, now every minute they check what product I'm selling, not just how much, not just how big a pension I'm getting, but what product I'm selling, and I want to get out of this system. They would say to me, look, I want to keep, I don't want them to have the names of my customers. I don't want them to know whether I'm pushing real estate investment trusts. You know, so suddenly I saw that a lot of the industrial techniques to keep track of each person's work were being added to the job that was supposed to be, you know, an intellectual job through this electronic computers. And that's how I got the subject, the electronic sweatshop.
And sweatshop, why do you use that word again?
Well, even if the jobs were at that time slightly better paid, people were timed, sped up, you know, monitored on work that you didn't think could be broken down the way industrial work could. You know, people who answered telephones and sold airline reservations. Those were the chapters, people doing airline reservations whose boss would tell them, I know you must ask this question first and you can't ask that question third, you know, best practices.
And I think I remember a chapter about someone who had a difficulty helping the people she was talking to because of the programs she used.
Right. Oh, yes, very much. And people who had to send out form letters that they knew were just stalling for time from Blue Shield Blue Cross of California so that people wouldn't get paid. But they couldn't get the information off the system if they tried to get the right letters out. I mean, it was really something. And it was part of something which, am I ahead of my time? Was I behind my time? It was something we now know that the turning us into this kind of robot, or just lowering our pay, making us dispensable, is something that has reached higher up the economic ladder. It's reached to white-collar workers, so that at this point, people I interviewed in down the up escalator who had lost jobs during the recession, when the recession was over, their jobs had been reorganized so that even if they were as skilled as one particular person who did the graphics on textbooks, I mean, by graphics, I don't mean pictures, I mean, you know, setting it up technically for the computer, he kept saying to me, well, I'm still unemployed, I'm still unemployed, I'm still unemployed. And then I noticed that he was actually doing the work, but he was doing it in little bits of part-time jobs. And it turned out that his company that had fired 20 people in his category just set it up so that the work was being done. You were now a contract worker. I noticed this. I told a lot that same story several times about people who lost their job during recession. And I remember I used to get so angry because you'd hear these reports at the end of the recession that work is returning, but the low-paid work is returning first, like the high-paid work was going to be returned later. But I described at particular places how the jobs had been reorganized, how the recession had been used as an excuse to fire full-time people and reorganize the job right then and there so that afterwards it never had any benefits and was done by people who were working 5 hours, 4 hours, whatever was needed that day.
And what kind of jobs specifically? Could you give us some example?
One of them was a fancy, very fancy. I had a sister of a friend who worked at a fancy boutique on Madison Avenue. And you may not think of that as a skilled job, but she was the kind of person that dressed people. I mean, for the season. People came in, very rich people came in and said, you know what I like, what have you got for me? And she really cared about that job. I remember the first thing she said when she looked at me, she said, boy, you know, you could keep wearing those thrift store clothes, jackets. We just put it together with one pair of petite pants that fit. You know, she just did that all the time. She loved it. And she was their highest earning. Now, this store, it's not just a Madison Avenue boutique. It's a women's brand. I think she's still working there, so I'm not going to mention the name. I just called it the boutique. Next time you call me, I will mention. I'm sure she's going to quit soon. Anyway, they had people who worked there a long time. She had been there, of 160 stores, she had been their highest commission saleswoman several years in a row. I mean, she was really hot shot. And when the recession hit, yes, they lowered people's hours. And at first she said, okay, business is down. It really is down. They're telling us every 2 weeks what our schedule is for the next 2 weeks. And mine is down to like 5 hours a week, 10 hours a week. And but then she, and I talked to people over a long period of time. She began to notice that for all of that, it wasn't sharing work among the women there. They were still hiring new people right in the middle of all this happening. And eventually they called the old people together and they said, look, there's going to be no more commissions in this store and no more health insurance. And if you want to quit, we won't contest your unemployment insurance. In other words, unemployment insurance became their kind of severance pay.
Hmm.
And the recession by that time had already picked up. And you know something, it did pick up faster for fancy stores than cheap stores. And it did pick up faster in New York, where there's so many rich people, than in other places. So business was booming again at the point that they were told, you can leave. You can leave because you're never going to get back to those old conditions. And this particular woman was older. Everybody else left, she said. And the reason I'm not giving the name of the store is because she's still working there, because for her, her husband was retired, and she just liked going in to see her old customers. So she's still doing it at the much lower paid $8-$9 an hour for pay without without benefits. Her retirement preoccupation. And she's also working for a charity where she takes women who've been in bad conditions, who might have been prostitutes, and she puts outfits together for them. I mean, she loves doing this. This is a skilled job if you do it right. So there's one example. In other words, when people said, I went, ha ha, I tried to write about it. When people said, when the government said, the good jobs have come back first. I mean, the bad jobs have come back first. The good jobs will come back later. It was all part of that same, now they call it inequality, more money going to the investors and the owners, less money going to the workers. That's been going on over the, oh, God, my God, it's more than 40 years now, almost 50 years that I've been writing these book a decade about ordinary workers. And this recession book, it isn't really a recession book. Before, down the up escalator, my publisher wanted a quickie recession book, but it turned out to be a book about those 40 years and how the lowered and stagnant wages led to a, at the same time the productivity was increasing so greatly, led to a process where working people couldn't buy the products they produced. And so the brilliant capitalist class said, well, I have an idea. Instead of paying you enough to buy what you produce, I'll lend you the money. So there was one essentially debt crisis after another, the last of which, well, the most recent of which is the mortgage debt crisis. The next, well, I'm not going to predict that it'll be the student debt crisis.
Well, Barbara, before I want to come back to and spend some time on the new book, but a couple of other questions about the older work before we leave that. You talked about people who were reservationists and so forth, didn't you, in the electronic sweatshop?
Yes, I did.
And how do we understand those jobs? What's happened there?
Well, actually,
the call
what
centers
was happening and what was noticing is at first the reservation clerks with the new computers were given more exact scripts, the scripts that statistically the fastest salesmen made airline reservations. Because they are salesmen, you know, scripts that said, look, you're not allowed to say, do you want a book? You have to say, do you want the 4 o'clock or the 10 o'clock? You know, that's old salesman stuff. You're not allowed to let the person off the hook. And they were given these scripts, and they had to do it. But, you know, that was only part of a process. Because the more and more you would say, my God, am I talking to a machine? The more and more the management worked it out, so in fact it could be done by a machine. Now you book yourself, you know, you answer, you check those questions yourself and do the work yourself. So that was happening as I was writing the electronic sweatshop. You saw people being tailorized, systemized, the jobs being made stupider and stupider, until the point where, in fact, at the ATM machine, you processed your own withdrawal. At the airlines, you did your own booking, unless you had a very special problem.
You used the word tailorized. Talking about old words, there's an old word. Maybe you could tell us what you mean by tailorized. And also, Barbara, I noticed in a couple of places you refer to someone from the older generation, Harry Braverman, and I thought that was interesting to see. Maybe you could give us a little information about this idea of tailorization and maybe tell us a little bit about your reading of Harry Braverman.
Well, he wrote a book called Labor and Monopoly Capital, which described you might say, I sometimes feel I'm the Comics Illustrated version of serious books like Labor and Monopoly Capitalism, or Piketty. I am the Comics Illustrated version, or the light version of Piketty, because I'm going through individual people's lives who may or may not realize what's happening to them. And if I'm describing the way their management is trying to make them more dispensable, trying to get more of their money, more of the money that comes into the company into returns for investors and less paid to workers. And one sad way of doing that is to make the workers' actual jobs so repetitive, so simple, that he has no weight in the company. He can't demand anything. You don't worry about firing him because somebody, someone else can be trained in very quickly. And Taylorism, good old Frederick Taylor, you should explain it. You know that stuff better than I do. Good old Frederick Taylor was a person who first invented that way of dividing up work that was previously very skilled in places like steel mills, where they depended at one point on the judgment of a man who said, okay, it's hot enough now, pour. And they really studied his work to divide it up in such a way that you could just say so many seconds and you were going to pour.
Okay. And Braverman, who was he?
Oh, Harry Braverman wrote a wonderful book called Labor and Monopoly Capital, which I recommend almost as highly as I recommend my own books. It's like my books describe that same process, only I have it through the mouths of the people who are actually doing the jobs.
And before we leave again, we didn't get to the call centers and how they fit into this picture, the offshore call centers.
I didn't do too much with offshore call centers because I didn't go. The call centers I was looking at were in the United States at the time. But some of the work, like the work of graphics illustrators, the graphics people, the computer work was going to be moved offshore, but others, as I said, was going to be made so automatic that you, the customer, actually did the work, as is the case. The airline reservation people I spoke to, their jobs they totally disappear, but they tended to disappear. Very few of them left. Only old biddies like me who insist on calling on the telephone instead of filling in the boxes myself. So they became part of what happened in the last over the 40 years that I've been writing, since from 71 to the 2007, right before the recession. Productivity in the United States increased 99%. That is, it nearly doubled. And a lot of that is what I just described. You had 1,000 reservation takers before. Now you have 10 guys that handle the people with problems, and the rest of you do it online yourself. You pick the dates and the times and book the flight and give them your credit card numbers. You fill that in yourself. So that's part of the productivity that meant the airline was doing the same amount of business but paying very little in the form of wages. That's the boring way to say it, but when you actually watch the people who are trying still to actually help the customer, and the job has been set up so they just can't do it, or they're in some ways their productivity is declined, their bonuses are declined if they take the time to find out what the real problem is instead of going on and saying, well, do you want the 4 o'clock or the 10 o'clock? So I watched that happening in the electronic switch up, and I watched that productivity increase at the same time that wages stayed flat or declined in those same years, 72 to 2007. Actually, wages went up 4%, but that includes a lot of high wages. So that means that's not 4% a year. That's 4% over nearly 40 years. So what I'm describing is what wound up in what we all know, a huge recession because people can't afford to buy what they produce. So in various forms, they will lend the money. Well, that's only a very short-term solution.
Barbara,
the real solution is to get the money back, get the value of what we produce, even if we work fewer hours.
Barbara, I have to pause here for just a moment. I need to say this is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our program today is an antinomian hour. Our guest is Barbara Garson, the playwright and author, and we've been talking about her books about ordinary people and the work they do. Well, Barbara, your newest book then, and it seems to be, you've subtitled it, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession.
The recession came off. It was on the hardcover. And when my publisher saw that it really was a book about the economic decline that led to the recession, just titled it Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live.
I see. Okay, well, what inspired this book, or unfortunately, what inspired it?
What inspired it? Well, I was foolish enough to forget how hard it was to go out and interview so many strangers and catch their exact speech pattern and tell their complicated stories with all the personal parts of it and still somehow, you know, till the economic story was happening. I forgot how hard it was to do, and so when the recession hit, I thought, well, let me do that again. It's like the, I wonder if I'll ever do it again. I don't know. And so I described this, what I thought was a turning point, and it has turned out to be a turning point, at least in people's realization. Because for four decades, I've been describing something that people say didn't exist. I'm your antinomian. That ordinary working people, and included white-collar working people, and now is beginning to include professionals, that they were simply getting shafted, that they were working harder for less money, less benefit, and less fun at work, less security. That's the main thing. I mean, that's what makes you feel different.
And
life hard.
And the kind of people you interviewed, some examples?
Well, I told you about the lady who was the best salesman in her company for so many times, and her job was lost, or rather her hours were cut, and then after the recession they began to use more temporary help even as business picked up. I went to everybody. I went to unemployed bankers. I went to people who were struggling with housing problems, who never, you know, basically who lost their houses. And more of the property, as we're seeing, is becoming rental housing. They lost their houses. They're renting their houses now, and other people now own that property. However complicated it seemed to them at the time, however struggling they were with the pathetic Obama mortgage modification problems. God, I was in the middle of Richmond, California. I do come back to California because that's where I went to school. And I went to Richmond, California, which is an almost all-black city, and watched people who heard all about Obama modifications and thought they could save their houses and were ensnared by their banks into loans and modifications of their loans that were only delaying the losing of their house till the banks could really make better use of it, till the banks could sell it or turn it into a rental mortgage, rental housing security bond. And it was pathetic. I'm like, I'm sorry to say it, but I remember talking to one black woman in Richmond, California, who had owned her house free and clear by the 1980s and was foolish enough to remortgage it so that she could help her children buy houses. You could say she was a speculator, too. She got in on that housing boom thing. But she was, you know, propagandized all the time, phone calls every night, and she finally did it. And I remember when she was actually losing her house, and she thought she had gotten an Obama modification, as people in Richmond called it. And in fact, it was just a creepy loan company, which was eventually bought by Goldman Sachs and sold by Goldman Sachs, I've got to say that. And they offered her a modification she didn't understand, where it turned out she was paying almost nothing, well, actually nothing, on the principal in the house. And she wound up working three jobs. She was a housing, you know, a home care assistant. She wound up working three shifts sometimes to try to make the $5,200 mortgage she was paying, which wasn't paying anything toward the principal on her loan. And I remember her particularly because when I was speaking to her, which was the day before she was losing her house, or the day after court, she didn't know what day they would come and empty her furniture out, she thanked me for listening and writing about her story. Well, that was the moment I finally broke down. I mean, I listened to these stories, but I started to tear up. And she said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "You're thanking me, and my stories never do anybody any good." And she said, "Oh, I know what you mean." Remember, she's a home care worker. "I know what you mean. My patients always die." And she's consoling me. And I mean, well, that was in Richmond, California. And it just illustrated the pathetic nature of the solution to the housing crisis that covered all possible losses for the banks and covered nothing for ordinary people who, in this case, thought they were getting an Obama loan and were... I mean, this woman said, "I'm not going to vote for Obama again." I couldn't believe a black church woman in Richmond, California, telling me she wasn't going to vote again for the first black president.
Well, what
I bet she did vote for him.
what was Obama?
Because we haven't offered any alternative.
What was it? What was it supposed to do? The new regulation.
It was a very complex plan by which the government would give the banks cash, would subsidize the banks in terms of cash to the bank, if they modified a person's mortgage, lowered the interest rate or the principal, so that they could stay in their house, so they could temporarily or permanently, hopefully, meet their mortgage payments. But it was purely voluntary. Banks, only thing the banks had to do if they signed up for the program was to accept the modification proposals. Turned out, I have some interesting, from Bloomberg, some interesting statistics turned out after my book came out about how they used that program to accept these modifications, to give people the hope, to accept these applications, to give people the hope that their application was being processed. They set up phony centers. If a person would complain after 6 or 8 months, they would send them letters that now seem to come from the office of the CEO, which was just as phony as anything else. The office of the CEO of some of those big banks were, you know, out in Colorado. And they would send them letters, and they would just keep stalling them and stalling them and stalling them along till they got every possible penny they could get out of them, none of which went to paying off the principal of the house. And then they might turn down the loan, or the person had lost the house by then. But they would give people hope, and it was a false hope. And the people thought they were applying for a what they called an Obama modification, HAMP, Housing... what it was called. What does HAMP stand for?
But it's not...
Modification program was the last two. Home Affordable Modification Program. Mm.
So it was more than just the...
It was heartbreaking.
More than just the refinancing of the house because, say, they tell you that the rates are lower.
Right. No, these people wouldn't have been eligible for refinancing.
I see.
It was a government program. The program still exists. It's been modified. Maybe it's better now, maybe it isn't. I see ads on daytime television from people saying they will help you with these applications.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine if a government program is so difficult that you need a shyster, you need to give somebody else 10% of your house in order to get through the program. I mean, it is heartbreaking.
And
it's all part of the same processes that are going on for 40 years. However you twist it and turn it, student loans illustrate the same thing. The class of investors gets a bigger and bigger part of the money produced in productive industries and of the houses and so on. They own them. You rent them.
So that's
it's just that inequality. It's just I'm Piketty before Piketty. Only it's human interest. It's
So you said people, that, Barbara.
It's investors getting returns, getting bigger and bigger returns, maybe out of a smaller pie, because the economy can be stagnant, and that they become even more desperate for a bigger percentage to come as returns to investor and a smaller percentage to go to the homeowner or the student who borrowed or the working person.
So you've mentioned, excuse me for interrupting, but you've mentioned a couple of times now Piketty, and I some of our listeners will know who you're talking about and others won't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Would you mind telling us just what you're referring to, who this
There's
is?
There's a great and justified brouhaha about a very technical book, well-written but very technical, by a Frenchman who makes a statistically acceptable to people like Paul Krugman case that greater and greater returns have been going to investors and that the post-war period, which you and I grew up in, where, you know, ordinary working people were doing pretty well, is an anomaly in capitalism. He even uses the word capitalism. He didn't used to use those words before. And he's getting great accolades and has a best-selling book. And that we're approaching a period where inequality is as great as in the Gilded Age before World War II. And that there's really no way to reverse it except to take the money away from them. It's not going to be through capitalist growth. And that's something that Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz haven't said clearly till now. And I'm so glad they're saying it. And in Down the Up Escalator, I say it too. I look at some kids. I'm writing about the recession, and I start interviewing some kids who have been sent to my building, which is low enough income to qualify for a government stimulus program to upgrade weatherization on certain houses. And they're working on that weatherization program, and I'm so glad they're hired. They're wonderful kids. Look, I'm so old that 30-year-olds are kids. And they're wonderful people, and I'm so glad they're doing the job. But I caution people that a stimulus program that's based on borrowing more money from rich people and paying that back with interest later is not good enough. And I say, I have a heading that says, don't borrow, take. We just had, and Piketty calls for a global tax, not on income, but on wealth, on the money accumulated in brokerage accounts and banks. And I just say we have to do that. We have to have what you might call a every 50-year redistribution. You just have to take the money from them and spread it out differently.
Through a tax.
He wants to do it through a tax. Maybe, Cal, you'll do it through a revolution. Maybe they won't let themselves be taxed. But it won't do to simply stimulate the economy by borrowing money from them, creating a government or private debt that has to be paid back to them and leaves them even richer than before. Because if ordinary people don't have enough money to spend, the situation just... You know what it's like? I have a kid in all little days playing Monopoly with his parents. And he wants to keep the game going. And the more money and the more property he has, the more money he gets. And if he doesn't want the game to end, if he wants to stay up past his bedtime and keep the parents playing, he has to slip them some money, even if he has to break the rules of the game to do it. And these capitalists are going to have to break the rules of the capitalism they established to redistribute that wealth. Now, there was some real redistribution in the 30s, and there was some not real redistribution. We have to do it again. And Piketty, I'm so glad. He is like the... he gives it a statistical basis to saying this will run itself down if we don't do something to redistribute. And I show it in the lives of ordinary people who can no longer borrow, no longer own houses, and meantime, their owners or their the people who gave them their mortgage are accumulating more and more.
And this is this where the new argument about the fact that it's no longer sort of an era of very smart entrepreneurs working themselves up to be billionaires, but the wealth is more concentrated in the hands of families?
Well, that's something that Piketty shows. I'm not sure of his statistics on that. I have to say, when I say I'm Piketty before Piketty, Thomas Piketty, that doesn't mean I'm really before him. He and his colleagues have been collecting these statistics for a long time, and they're the kinds of statistics. I use very few statistics, but the statistics about the increasing gap, like the ones I just gave you about the 4% wage increase over a period of 40 years. He's been collecting those statistics, and I use some of his statistics, but I am not an economist. He is certainly saying that as wealth accumulates this way, it just keeps accumulating. There's no stopping it. You don't have to be bright. You can be the son of, because things are set up so that capital, you have the money, you have it in the bank, you have it in the brokerage account, you're going to get more. And you're going to get a bigger share of what's around. I'm not able, I don't feel confident to verify his statistics now and in all countries that it's an inherited, if we are moving into an inherited ruling class instead of a entrepreneurial ruling class. He says that. It might be true. I don't say it because it's not the kind of thing I come across when I'm actually writing.
Okay, so the book, your book, Down the Up Escalator, that's a lot of it is about foreclosures. Another chapter is Innovating Jobs Away. We've talked a little bit about that, but do you want to bring us up to date on what you're saying?
Well, I described it a few times, how the jobs are reorganized so that it's now only a I got the phrase out of a broker. I was talking to a stockbroker who had lost, a stock analyst, a person who works for a big hedge fund. Well, actually, he worked for a small hedge fund. I don't know how small a small hedge fund was. It was only in the hundreds of millions or something like that. And he worked for a small hedge fund, and he lost his job. And he had to keep up to date with things so that when he went out looking for another job, he could give the people ideas of how to do things. And I described to him what happened to the woman who was a full-time career worker in that fancy boutique and was replaced during the recession and then never given the old conditions back by people who had this now as a part-time job. They would fill in as many hours as was needed each week, and if they couldn't make it, they couldn't make it, and somebody else, there was enough other people to do it. And he said to me, I described that, and I asked him, could that kind of thing happen to brokers, to you, to analysts? He said, oh, no. But when he listened to the other companies, he said, you know, a lot of good, when I told him the details of the story, he said, yes, a lot of good innovations have come during recession. So he thought those were good innovations. So I went back to the woman who told me the story. And she was so pissed, you know. Oh, man, he thinks of that as an innovation. That's how I tell stories. Hmm. You get the point of it by their dialogue back and forth with each other. I don't have to say everything. So he called it an innovation. And that's why I headed my chapter, Innovating the Jobs Away, because when I described a couple of situations in which after the recession, business either had never fallen off or was back up, but the job was still being done by contract workers, by people like, you know, by the, who is it that teaches us in school now? Everybody is
the adjunct teacher.
An adjunct. By adjuncts, even in the most educated fields, that will never have real jobs in their life. And that's, unless something really big happens, that's the future of the young people who are borrowing so much money to go to college, and then their jobs will be They may be just as skilled, but they'll be considerably worse jobs. And something happening will be a political something happening. Economically, it's not going to correct itself. It's got to be them fighting, whether through unions or other means, or the government redistributing. It's not going to happen by itself.
Let me pause again, Barbara. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio, and I'm your host today, Cal Winslow, and our guest is Barbara Garson, and we've been talking about several of her many books, her latest being Down the Up Escalator, which just came out last year from Doubleday.
It's a paperback now.
It's in paperback now.
Yeah, an anchor paperback.
Anchor paperback. And just before we leave that, I know you haven't mentioned this, although you did say something about McDonald's at the very beginning. There's quite a bit of discussion about the idea of a $15 an hour minimum wage. Does that fit into your thinking at all as something?
Sure. It's better than it's a hell of a lot better than $7.50, isn't it? In fact, it's just about twice, isn't it? No, yes, it's exactly twice. Why not? Absolutely, it's wonderful. And the effort to get it is going to be very difficult. I'm so glad it's happening. It gives me nice, hopeful picket lines to go out again.
Good.
Like we used to. Cal and I, we knew each other. We went to the University of California at Berkeley.
So let's go all the way back there for a minute, and let me ask you, this is this year, 2014, is 50 years since 1964. So let's go back there for a minute, if you don't mind, Barbara. How did you get out to Berkeley? And you were an undergraduate there, is that right?
Yes. I was never more than an undergraduate anywhere. And actually, my husband got kicked out of college. I was married at 17. What a stupid mistake. I mean, don't do that, anybody out there. And we went out to Berkeley because the University of California was free to people, to residents. And being married, we were residents within 6 months. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine how different times were?
And so you became a...
Free! That wonderful college was free.
And you became a history major. And
right. Well, to tell you the truth, I had taken a lot of mythology courses at Brooklyn College, and so when I got out there, they were willing to count all that mythology as Greek history. I'm not a very serious student, but I do love history. And I do consider this series of four books to be sort of a history of the changes that have happened to American people. I say working class, and everybody thinks that means only industrial workers, but to American, to anybody who earns a salary over the last 40 years, who lives on their salary, let's say.
And so what were you doing when the fall of 1964 came along?
Oh, I got so involved in the free speech movement, I can't even remember what our classes were like. But I was in the free speech movement, and in September, the end of September, the beginning of October, I'll be going back to Berkeley for the 50th anniversary reunion of a big sit-in around a police car. That was just one of the touching-off phases. What happened at Berkeley is that students were working in the civil rights movement and to help the farm workers organize, down in Southern California, and in the valley, let's say. And suddenly we were not allowed to even collect pennies on the outskirts of the campus. We were told that we couldn't do anything, we couldn't pass out leaflets or do anything that related to off-campus activities. Well, obviously, we were hurting the financial interests of important people on the Board of Regents and in the state of California. So the free speech movement was really a very simple and pure movement. It said, we don't want you telling, you can control where we distribute leaflets for traffic and so on, but when you come along and say, we can talk about certain things and not about others, we can talk about on-campus issues and not off-campus issues, That was to us a free speech movement, and the whole university got drawn into it. And we did, after a couple of terms, completely succeed. The rules were completely changed, and it involved mass sit-ins, and it was the first such student, quote, rebellion of the 60s. Though, don't you remember, we were hardly rebels at all. We were such good kids, and we just couldn't believe that our university administrators would lie to us the way they kept doing, and letting things go, and then trying to expel the ringleaders over Christmas because they think we all forgot, you know. I think it was amazing. So we're going back, and I guess there's a lot of people listening to the radio in Mendocino County who were part of the free speech movement in the old people. And so maybe they'll all show up at the reunion, too. It'll be the last weekend in September, first weekend in October.
And so you were arrested, Barbara?
Oh, yeah, which is no big distinction. It's not particularly brave. Remember that over 800 of us were arrested.
And why? What did you do?
At that point, we sat in at the, after everybody was, you know, after the leaders were fired and sat. At a certain point, after a hugely extended period of negotiating with the administration to try to be able to express, you know, our opinions on these issues, we had a sit-in. And the sit-in resulted in those enormous first arrests of the student movement of the 1960s. And then we all got out of jail, and then the faculty voted in our favor, and then between one thing and another, we actually won. I think it's the only thing I've been involved in that won.
And
what about you? Have you gotten any things that actually won since
then? I don't
know.
It's hard to think of something, isn't it?
My daycare center stayed open at a certain point.
Yeah. So, and then, so was that sort of the beginning of a lifetime of activism and
I think so.
Dissent
and I think
for you?
It was a beginning that put me in a non-bitter thing because, you know, we were so idealistic and we won. And then when the Vietnam War started, now I know a lot of people think that that was a movement builder, but in fact, to me, it was a huge deflator of what was a movement to make this country better. I mean, suddenly we were only fighting anti, and we exhausted ourselves fighting against a war. And you know, when it's all over, what have you got? You've got the peace to start your other movements, your civil rights movements and your labor movements all over again, but they're considerably deflated. So I was very fortunate again. I had a little baby by then, and during the Vietnam War, instead of organizing big demonstrations, the work I did was to work at a coffee house near an army base. And army bases are in these little small towns, and really we just provided a place for GIs who felt the same way to get together. Well, who didn't feel the same way, but just wanted to listen to a different kind of music. And so many things came out of that coffee house. GI newspapers, boycotts against grapes, because, you know, the army was breaking Cesar Chavez's grape strike in order to break the strike. The army was buying huge amounts of grapes. GIs would boycott grapes, GIs would start trying to form a union. I mean, there was amazing things going on at that period. And our coffee house provided, well, legal protection when they needed, a place to get together, you know, civilian contacts to GIs who were doing an awful lot. And that put me in touch with the kind of people that I wrote about later. It kind of kept me feeling good about America, where I think I might have felt bad if I was part of the political sectarian struggles that also existed in the 70s, you know, the Weathermen and things like that. I was always involved with pretty nice, ordinary Americans.
You've talked about a couple of them in your writing. Could you relate one story for us?
Well, actually, a person who's in my first book is in my last book. A person who's in All the Live Long Day reappears in Down the Up Escalator, although I have to admit he is dead by the time he reappears in Down the Up Escalator, but his family isn't. When I was working at the GI Coffee House, I met a young person who, you know, people come and people go. I liked him a lot. He was not a big militant. He wasn't like John Kerry. He didn't stay a veteran after the war. He went home to enjoy the counterculture. But then when I was writing a story about the strikes at the Lordstown auto plant in Ohio, there he was working there. And it was a very controlled situation, and he had to just pass me a note. And I met him afterwards. And he just told me wonderful stories about working there, or hating working there, expected to move on. And then, while I was, and he was a very skilled worker, Duane. I mean, he kept up with all the technology of the 80s and 90s. He programmed computers within factories. He never was really unemployed. But I got word of his memorial service, of his funeral or memorial service, while I was riding down the up escalator. And by talking to his children, I realized that here's a person who worked his whole life, was not a big spender. His whole family reminded us that their kids were never allowed to buy the newest sneakers, and they didn't buy big screen televisions. And he and his wife both worked during these years. Well, eventually they separated, but and I'm sorry for that. But still, it was a two-income family for most of the time. And when he died, his family inherited a house that was very beautiful, that he did a lot of the woodwork on, a lot of built-ins. But the housing values had just crashed. He'd moved out to Arizona to work on and some kind of laser technology, but still a factory worker. The housing values crashed. The children could not sell the house for anything like, they would owe the bank $200,000 if they could sell the house at that point. They couldn't afford to keep it up, and they just walked away, at the advice of a lawyer, they just walked away from the house. And that's what, you know, sent the keys back to the bank, never took possession. And he died with leaving them a few thousand dollars death pay from the company and about $6,000 in debt on his credit card and the house that wasn't at that particular moment worth anything they could sell it for. And I just realized, I mean, it was the end of a story that, I mean, because he was a funny guy. I can't repeat all his jokes, but I got a lot of his jokes in the book. He was a sardonic kind of guy. And it made a very sad ending for me, who's been knowing someone like that and helped him when he was an anti-authoritarian, anti-army GI. And all these years pass, and we who thought everything was just going to get better and better after the 60s, that's in fact the decline of working class, if you will, life that happened that we didn't prevent, we didn't help, we didn't do anything to make it better.
Well, thinking about that and about 1964,
oh,
what a happy ending. But Barbara, at your great play, MacBird. But I have to say that we're out of time. This is Cal Winslow. I'm your host today. Our program is an Antinomian Hour. And quite properly, though, I think, because we're talking about people who work against the grain, and we've certainly heard a lot about how important it will be to work against the grain. Our guest has been Barbara Garson. Barbara is the author of the very interesting, very important new book, Down the Up Escalator, just out in paperback. And we'll be looking for your next book, Barbara. Thanks so much for coming on the program. It's been a real pleasure. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And I'll be back next week at the same time. So good afternoon.